Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, we're online, and of course, on your smart speaker. Coming up, Chinese cyber hackers have targeted British MPs as the government blames the country for illegitimately accessing millions of British voters' personal details. Plus, we're living in a dangerous climate of harassment and censorship, which is threatening free speech. That's the warning from the government's most senior advisor. And reconciling with Harry is the last thing on William's mind, as the Sussexes weren't told of Kate's cancer due to fears about the trust. Good evening, Britain, and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, right here on Talk TV. There's a lot to go at tonight as we kickstart the week, ladies and gentlemen. First up, does anyone really care if the Chinese are hacking into all our systems in this country? Everyone I know assumed they've been doing it for years. Second, will anyone in power take notice of Dame Khan's report today that we are in danger of handing over our hard-won democracy to the mob who vow to destroy it? And third, why on earth are we paying millions of pounds through the nose to tool up civil servants who refuse to come to work? You know you'll get the answers to all these questions and more. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Stand by beds. Now, the blame for two malicious cyber attack campaigns in the UK has been placed firmly with China-affiliated state actors by the Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowden today. One, an attack on the Electoral Commission in 2021, where hackers accessed the personal details of 40 million British voters. And the second, a series of targeted attacks on China-critical MPs. Dowden, though, insisted the government has got it all under control.
Our political processes and institutions have not been harmed by these attacks. The government will continue to call out and condemn this kind of activity in the strongest terms. We will continue to work with our allies to ensure that Chinese state-affiliated actors suffer the consequences of their behaviour. And we will take preventative action to ensure these attempts do not succeed. The cyber threat posed by China-affiliated actors is real and it is serious, but it is more than equaled by our determination and resolve to resist it.
I'm joined now by a former diplomat with over 20 years' experience in China, Hong Kong and Taiwan, Mr. Charles Parson. Charles, very good evening to you. Welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. One question, really, I suppose, to begin with. Why has Oliver Dowden decided to tell us all about this now?
Well, that is a good question, because they've known about it for quite some time. Mm. But one might say better late than never, because I think it is important to air these sorts of things, give them publicity.
Yes, no doubt. But, I mean, in terms of what damage they may or may not have done, according to Oliver Dowden, not very much. So what is the point of the government kind of suggesting that China is out to get us? Because all the people I've spoken to today said, well, we assume that we're under surveillance from China anyway, aren't we?
Well, yes, we are, but I think we should make the task much more difficult for them. I mean, the first thing to say is that if it wasn't worthwhile, China wouldn't do it. And clearly they do put an awful lot of effort into these sorts of cyber attacks and other forms of espionage. So clearly they see some value in it.
Yeah, I'm sure they do, but it's a question of whether it's you know, as annoying as having your bank account hacked by somebody who's trying to take your money, or whether it's actually something far more sinister. You know, I mean, for example, if they've got information from the Electoral Commission, you know, maybe we could call them up and ask them which way everybody's going to vote in the next election.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little more serious than that. I mean, if you take, there was a case, two cases actually, in Canada, where the Chinese vice consul in Vancouver claimed that she'd been responsible for the two people losing their seats. And indeed, if you look at the voting patterns, it was very against against the trend of things, and they lost their seats, or presumably the Chinese enabled them to lose their seats because they were very anti-Chinese. And what they did was to mobilize an awful lot of Chinese diaspora voters to go against the people who the Chinese didn't like. Now, if you've got hold of the electoral roll, for instance, here in the UK, I think there are two worries. One is it just adds to the information that they're collecting on individuals. You get name, who you live with, address, etc. Put that with other things and you can start targeting people for attacks on them. But also, if you were, for instance, trying to, let's say Mr. Ian Duncan Smith, Sir Ian Duncan Smith was in a constituency where there was likely to be a very narrow vote. Well, if you can get out a couple of hundred voters to vote against him, you might be able to get rid of him. So there is the possibility of actually influencing our democracy. Is it going to bring UK democracy to its knees? Not this particular instance. It's chipping away, but surely we shouldn't be allowing people to chip away at our democracy.
No, but I mean, as long as there's data, there will be somebody trying to get that data for themselves. And I mean, it's probably pretty easy to get data if you're the Chinese government these days, not least because of all the social media activity that we know about. I mean, Facebook knows more about me than China does any day of the week.
Yeah, there is a difference, though, and I've heard this argument a lot of times, if you'll excuse me, even from people who are MPs and others.
Yeah.
Well, my data goes to Facebook or Instagram or whatever, what's the difference? Well, I think there is a big difference, actually. I mean, first of all, there's a difference between a hostile state taking your data and a company. You can sue these companies, you can't sue China. On the whole, American companies, let's say, that are actually... roughly on our side in terms of supporting the sorts of interests and values that we have, China isn't. So, if you gave me the choice of would I rather my data to be stolen by a big company or by China, it's not a great choice, but I'd go for the company.
Well, yeah. But I mean, I'd rather it wasn't stolen at all. But the fact remains that Oliver Dowden got up today, made quite a serious speech in Parliament, warning about all sorts of things that could happen, without really giving us any form of... sort of defence as to how it was going to be stopped from happening and what would happen if it did, in fact, breach into all sorts of national security. Would there be sanctions? I mean, I think no government that I've seen in this country for a long time has got the stomach for it.
Well, maybe this is the start of a reaction. I mean, I do think it helps to publicise these things and make a noise about them. If you're subject to behaviour from a bully, the best thing to do is to make a noise about it rather than just to go into a corner and keep quiet about it.
Yeah.
So that's
fine. But, I mean, in the good old days of the Cold War, as you might say, there was a bit of tit for tat, wasn't there? Then we'd have people messing around with China. I don't get the sense that anybody here's got the wherewithal or the guts to do it.
Well, neither you nor I know exactly what GCHQ and others do in terms of attacking China back. But I think it's, amongst other things, it's the sheer scale of what China's doing. And it's not just in the UK. And it's not just the electoral roll, of course. I mean, by going for people like Ian Duncan Smith and other MPs, what they're trying to do is to get into their private details, etc., see if there's anything that they can use to discredit them, whether it's their finances or some of their personal behaviour, and use that to stick it up on in disinformation on various forms of media. So I think it is relatively serious, whether it's the electoral roll or attacking individual people, discrediting our democracy. But as I say, is UK going to collapse tomorrow as a result? No, but I think it's far better than we just lie there and ask them to do whatever they want.
Yeah, no, I get that. Charles, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Charles Partner, former diplomat, with a great deal of knowledge about the Chinese diaspora and China and Taiwan and Hong Kong. Lord Dodson is here with me, my panel, of course, as well as contributor Esther Kreku. Very good afternoon and evening to you. I'm not trying to be flippant about this, but, I mean, it seems to me that it's a bit ridiculous for Oliver Dowden to get up and say, oh, my God, China have been hacking into our systems and they might get some information from us that could be dangerous, but we can't stop them, but I just want to tell you about it. Well, what's the point?
More like about time. I can't believe we've been so complacent for so long. First of all, this is a government which oppresses its own citizenry using a social credit system.
Yeah.
Has put hundreds of thousands of...
Talking about China or Britain?
China.
Sorry, so I wasn't sure where you were going there. I mean, you have written a couple of books about
this. Well, I'm going to come on to the state sphere, actually. But also has put hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs into basically concentration camps, has restricted the freedoms of people in Hong Kong. Of course we shouldn't be complacent about China. But going back to COVID, you know, we've just passed the four-year anniversary.
They also did give us COVID, by the way. Let's not forget
that. Thank you. So let's go back. You know, this is the four-year anniversary, basically, of lockdown. Remember how it started. First of all, potentially a lab leak, which the World Health Organization wasn't allowed to investigate.
Right.
Secondly, we copied China's lockdown, which is nothing that was recommended before. And, you know, we watched videos of state officials welding people into their apartments. Now, more fool us for mimicking them, but we did. And before that, do you remember the videos that were coming out of China?
Yeah.
People falling flat on
their
faces. Now, I was kind of roundly mocked for writing about this in a state of fear.
Yeah.
But I raised the question, is that a prank or a psyop? When a whole host of videos are created which show something which COVID never turned out to be.
Right.
They were distributed through TikTok and Weibo and then disappeared. Right. You know, if we had COVID, China had stunt COVID, then it goes on. You know, the 50 Cent Army has been known about for a long time. There was a study in 2017 that said that up to 2 million Chinese people work for the government, 50 cents apiece, in order to spread state-sponsored propaganda online.
Right.
So that's to steer the course of the narrative towards pro-government messaging. But it's taken a darker turn. It was used against Hong Kong, and it was also allegedly used to support Italy when it locked down, but also to criticise US governors that didn't implement statewide lockdowns.
Right.
So they have been bringing democracy to its knees for years.
Yes, but this is exactly my point. So why is Oliver Dowden suddenly now getting up in Parliament to go, oh, this is all terrible? Because let's not forget, Esther, when we talk about COVID, nothing was done about that. You know, there were people in the media, there were people in politics as well who said, you know, these people in China have wrecked the world's economy. They should pay some kind of reparations. What the hell has happened? Nothing has happened. People are still going around saying, oh, well, we had to have those lockdowns and now we haven't got any money. Well, blame China and get some money from them and stop going, oh, China, look, they're really dangerous. Well, how about you sanction them and go after them?
Well, that's the key point, because, one, I don't think you're going to get any accountability from the CCP. Their own citizens can't get accountability from them. We certainly are not. But I think the bigger question is our response. How robust can it be? What is the extent to what our response can be? The reality is that the world is in a sort of a very significant political realignment as we speak. You know, enemy states are what we consider enemy states.
Well, there's a lot more of them. Your microphone's just got a bit of an issue. Let me just fix your microphone because it's not working too well. Oh. Somebody's coming to do it. Sorry, Laura. The world is a very dangerous place. I mean, only today, we're going to be talking about it later on in the show. We hear that ISIS-K is a new operation, which is relatively new anyway, which is responsible for blowing up Kabul airport. Probably responsible for what happened in Moscow over the weekend. You know, they could be coming here, we're told. And so, you know, we live in a very dangerous place.
Yes, but regarding China, you know, they've allegedly targeted multiple countries. So we could all retaliate en masse and have some strength in numbers. What I found quite concerning about the message that came out of Downing Street today was that, you know, we can't cut China off completely because we're working on issues
like climate. Which is what I always say.
Climate change.
Right.
I mean, get real.
I know.
We basically offshore our manufacturing to China in the name of climate change. What we should be doing is forgetting all those climate change targets, bringing manufacturing and energy back into our country and not being reliant on China. That's hardly the reason
to cut off ties
with China.
I think your mic's working.
Yeah, thankfully. That's the wider point. We've left ourselves wide open.
Yeah. We make nothing
now. Well, no, it's not just about making nothing. We have not protected ourselves in the ways that matter. We've relied on sort of this model that's based on an American sort of world order that's collapsing before our very eyes. And where does Britain fit into this? How do we have what ability do we have to actually repel attacks from countries, hostile countries like China? And it's actually extremely limited. We don't have the ability to do that. So unfortunately, you know, the reason why Oliver Dowden didn't talk about the robustness of our defences against them is because I don't think they're very extensive.
No, exactly. I mean, it was only a few years ago, I seem to remember, that we were about to adopt a Chinese phone system in government, you know, in the very centre of Whitehall, which would be interchangeable with every government department. Huawei was the name of the company.
Belief,
we don't hear about that anymore.
Yeah.
We don't know what they're doing. You know, we've got Chinese companies building nuclear plants all over Europe. China owns most of the debt that is owed by the American government.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's kind of ridiculous to me to not stand up to them in some way. Because, you know, if this carries on, they can do pretty much what they like anyway. And we haven't even mentioned TikTok yet.
Well, we should be much more focused on efforts as a sovereign nation to be self-sufficient and resilient as far as possible when it comes to energy.
Yeah.
I mean, steel production. China's building coal stations. It's still producing yeah. steel. Why are we cutting back our ability to be self-reliant? Yes.
Well, I mean, I read a great article today talking about, you know, being a service-based economy is no longer enough. And it's true. You do need to have certain sort of protections for yourself as a country. You cannot leave yourself exposed to what happens in the world on every single front, particularly when it comes to countries like China. And so that's what we really need to be working on. We need to work on a 15 to 20-year plan to decouple ourselves from the heavy reliance we have on China. Because guess what? They're going to keep doing this. I'm not saying that the UK and many in the West don't spy on other countries. Of course they do. I'm not saying they don't necessarily influence regime change successfully or unsuccessfully.
We're supposed
to. Of course we do. So, you know, you could argue that it's a tit for tat, but actually that's not the main issue here. It's our ability to respond, our ability to protect ourselves. And that's what we are failing at.
And we found out, even as with something as simple and strange as the piano player at King's Cross Station. Yeah. Remember Bernard, who came in, I think his name was Bernard, who came in here to after he was stopped from playing the piano by some Chinese state actors who had turned up at King's Cross to make a video for Chinese New Year. And it turned out at least two of those people were high-ranking members in London of the Chinese Communist Party. You know, and then when they started challenging them, they started sort of saying things like, you can't speak to me like that, we will have you arrested, you're a racist. I mean, it was quite bizarre.
Yeah.
And there's lots of this stuff. We had the incident in Manchester where there was a demonstration outside the Chinese embassy.
And someone was
they pulled
drunk.
Some guy inside, beat him to a pulp. I mean, you know, they're doing whatever they want.
I mean, I think what should be said for the ability of nations like or countries like China to destabilize societies, the Western societies. Actually, the wider conversation should be why do they find it so easy to play on the kind of tensions we have, like where we can say everything is racist or is homophobic or whatever. It's because we've lost our mind.
Yeah.
So once we get back to a sensible common ground, they wouldn't be able to influence the country in this way.
Yeah, I agree. Totally. Good to see both of you. We will have you back very shortly. There's lots to discuss. This is, of course, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up next, a shocking report which details how Britain's democracy is under attack from within. Never mind China. Stay tuned. Welcome back. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. A damning report published by the government's counter-extremism czar, Dame Sara Khan, details how 75% of people are scared to speak their minds and that political violence, abuse, rape and death threats are commonplace in our society. I mean, I'm not surprised. We've been saying this for years here at Talk TV. Here's a clip of Dame Sara Khan.
Because if we don't do something about this growing phenomenon, and let me be very clear, from our polling, 60% of the public think this has got worse in the last 5 years. If we don't do something about this, I'm afraid we will see an erosion of these precious democratic rights and freedoms of our country. That is something that we cannot tolerate. This is what marks us out as different to authoritarian countries, for example, our plural democracy, the right to free speech, the right to exercise our democratic rights and freedoms as citizens. And it's the government's responsibility to ensure that those rights are protected.
Now, Laura Dodsworth and Esther Kreku are still with me, and I'm now joined as well by comedian Dave Chawner. So, welcome back. I didn't realise you weren't actually going, so here you are still, but Dave's with us now as well. This is an extraordinary report because we didn't really know this was coming out, I think, until Sunday, kind of in the course of reading the Sunday papers in the morning, that suddenly this report... To be honest, maybe I wasn't paying attention. I didn't even know it had been commissioned. But it was all done sort of in the wake of the Batley teacher who's still on the missing list, who is still in hiding. Nobody seems to have ever done anything about the teacher's job. I don't know what the teacher's doing. Nobody does. But it's a fascinating report. I'm not sure about some of the language and some of the numbers. I mean, it seems extraordinary that 75% of people have suffered death threats and rape threats. And, I mean, I know social media is pretty horrible. I mean, I've suffered all of that, but most people, I assume, don't, do they?
No, of course not. Look, I think that some of the sentiment behind this report is very well meant and very important. Mm. You know, what happened to that teacher at the school in Batley is horrific.
Yeah. And it's still happening.
And it's not a purely isolated example. But I've started reading the report and I haven't completed it, so I'm sorry if my reading of it's not completely coherent, but there's a few things about the report which strike me as a little bit concerning. First of all, what is freedom restricting harassment? I don't like this kind of doublespeak.
Yes.
I think we need to be careful of it. Freedom restricting harassment is going to be something that you hear online that alters your perception of your freedom. It doesn't necessarily alter your perception. Mm. So, for instance, you know, the report has some quite large figures for people who've moved home. Well, that's concerning. out of a survey of about 1,000 people. I'm not quite sure who they've surveyed, but a lot of people claim to have left social media or to have experienced it on social media. I fear that this report is something that softens us up for more censorship online, whereas another way of looking at this would be you can toughen up.
Right.
You can actually encourage people to be resilient in the face of name-calling or online hate. I mean, there are limits. When somebody incites violence or hatred or actually physically threatens you or your livelihood or something, that's something to take seriously. I fear that
it's quite often not taken seriously, though.
It's quite tough not, and that's another problem I'd have with this report. You know, there are certain sorts of freedoms that the establishment's very keen on protecting, and others it's not quite keen on, not quite so keen on naming. So I don't think enough is being said about which particular extremists we may be at risk from.
Yes.
In this report.
Well, here we go again. I mean, we've got like, for example, I mean, I'm assuming they must be talking about in the real world things like MPs getting visits at their homes from Just Stop Oil, or getting visits at their homes from pro-Palestine people saying that, you know, they should be ashamed of themselves and they're committing genocide while their children are inside sort of cowering and wondering what to do. But similarly, as you say, without anybody knowing who's to blame here, we're spending £31 million protecting our MPs from these extremists, but nobody's telling us who they are.
Well, no, and they're happy to take... This is what I find so baffling about that. They're happy to take the extra security our MPs are, but they're not questioning why or what has necessitated it,
right,
which is, it's very bizarre to me. Look, I'll be generous and say that I think with this report, or even of commissioning this report, the government's heart is in the right place. But actually, this is one of those times where, and we should have more of these conversations, this is above their pay grade. This is not something that I think is going to be best handled through with the use of policy or the typical levers of power. At the end of the day, you can't have harassment-free zones in front of a protest or whatever, these things that the
legislature... Well, one of the things she's proposing is like abortion clinics in the US and maybe here as well.
A buffer zone. I mean, it's completely impractical. If you really want to address this issue, and I don't think the government is the best vehicle to do this, you have to talk about the fact that the culture has changed.
Yeah.
Because 20 years ago, a lot of the things that you were able to say, you can no longer say it. So clearly the culture has regressed.
Right.
Now we have to ask, why is that? Well, because there are certain people in this society we're all living in that don't share British values. Because one of the top British values is being able to disagree on things in a civil way.
Yeah.
Being able to have public discourse about things that are sensitive, that are incendiary, but we have it in a way where we don't have to incite, right, we don't end up inciting violence
and Dave,
against
people. Let me bring you in, because you're a comedian. I mean, you know, a lot of comics, well, OK, it's arguable.
Yeah.
A lot of comics, though, are frightened of telling certain jokes. They're happy to tell other jokes because, politically speaking, they know that they'll be on the right side of, you know, whatever the common view is. But, I mean, do you feel as though there's things that you can't say as a result of what I would call intimidation or harassment or anything like that?
I don't think so at all. I mean, I know it would make for better news if I was like, I can't say anything.
Well, listen,
you go to a comedy club, and the amount of... There was a guy, like, literally, I watched it the other day, a guy was talking about, like, he was, you know, there was pro-Palestine, there was pro-Israel, and then they kind of, like, we kind of talked about it all, and it was fine. And I think it's...
Well, that's good to hear, though, because I'm surprised at that.
I think it's a mad statement to say we've regressed in the past 20 years. I don't know what that means.
But the thing is, okay, I'll give you an example. So someone like Trevor Phillips, who has gone up until, like... But you can date back to the early 2000s. He was talking about the fact that there are communities within the UK that are living parallel lives, that have not integrated into Britain, that are basically living... that are self-isolating and haven't adopted British values. 20 years ago, he could say that, and he wasn't isolated by the political establishment. Now, you can literally be doxxed, you can have your career or your job threatened for saying things that people disagree with. We may not have regressed. It may not be obvious in comedy because, obviously, comedy is where you push the limits. Obviously, you can't have the same kind of police on thought or language. But I get messages
all
the time.
Well, you can in Scotland now.
I can't say
these
things
because
it's my job. It is a real thing. There is a culture. People are feeling more censored because the social media, unfortunately, has made the repercussions for just stating an opinion unbearable.
Well, we haven't mentioned the trans lobby yet, have we?
No, but back to the buffer zone. I think the buffer zone outside of school is a ridiculous proposal.
Right.
Instead, how about not diluting the definition of Islamophobia,
right,
so that it's not ever considered acceptable to hound a teacher out of a school for showing a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad.
Because that's the bottom line. The teacher
that's
was hounded out of school and the teacher has never returned and never will. And that's the problem. But take this, for example, up in Scotland, Murdo Fraser, SNP, sorry, a Tory MSP, this is according to Russell Findlay, their legal expert. He says, MSP Murdo Fraser expresses an opinion about SNP gender policy. Number two, he's reported to the police, but Police Scotland don't tell him. Number three, police formally record a hate incident, but again, don't tell him. Are you still unconcerned about Humza Yousaf's hate crime law? So you could be reported in Scotland for saying something that is on Twitter because it's published in Scotland. You could be technically in breach of their hate crime law. They could technically come and take you away and arrest you, couldn't they?
Yeah, and also it can be recorded as a hate crime incident, which is something that can affect you getting jobs in the future if you have kind of a high-level
CLB check. Because it appears on your sort of a criminal background search.
Right? I'm a bit curious. Can someone explain to me what the difference between a crime and a hate crime is?
A crime and a non-crime hate crime. Well, a non-crime hate crime was meant to be something which was a bit hateful but not actually a crime, which was not something that could be acted upon by the police, so they couldn't arrest you. It wasn't a criminal act. However, they used to record them. Now, supposedly, according to my understanding of the rules, they've now been told to stop recording them. But clearly in Scotland they haven't.
In England.
Yeah, in Scotland they're still recording them.
OK. And so I'm assuming no crimes Willoughby, are motivated by love. Like, if someone is, I don't know...
There are crimes of passion, surely you know about those. I'm amazed you haven't been a victim of one.
But the thing is, if you stab someone, for instance, it's a crime. But if you stab someone because... I don't know what kinks some people have, but okay. But surely by the act of stabbing someone, you have committed a crime. Why do we have to qualify it? Are some crimes,
well, even though it's the same, I'll give you an example of that. When I lived in Scotland, a guy was dragged off by the police after getting in a fight in a bar. Mm-hmm. Not because he got in a fight in a bar, but because before he punched the other guy, he called him an English bastard. And because he used the word English, he was called on all sorts of other crimes, which were all about race and hate, instead of about assault. So he got done for assault, plus some race crime, plus... It was ridiculous.
And that's how me and Mike met.
Yeah, and I mean, you know...
He's been dragged away.
And that's the Edinburgh Festival for you. You know, but it's true, though.
It won't be like that anymore.
But it's true, though.
Another issue with this report, which I'm dying to read in full, because already just a few pages in, I'm a bit concerned by some of the predictions.
Is it a good page?
Hates it already.
Yeah, it is.
Hates it already.
Yeah. Mm. Careful, that's almost a crime.
I know.
Meeting report.
I hate the hate crime report.
The thing about it is that the government and this report claim not to want our freedoms to be restricted.
Yes.
But again, we're on the anniversary of lockdown. Not very long ago, they did want our freedoms restricted in all the most dramatic ways. But not only that, at the time, I remember Dame Cresta Dick saying, oh, we don't even need to police the mask mandates. The public will do the heavy lifting.
Yes.
They'll shame each other and police each other. So actually, when it suits the government, they like us to restrict our freedoms.
Yeah.
It always goes in one direction and not another.
Who could forget Priti Patel asking people to spy on their neighbours? And if you see your neighbours doing anything they shouldn't be doing, you know, call the police. Unbelievable. Police turning up at people's, student residences saying, how many people have you got in there? You know, is it six or seven? Let's have them all out on the street. It's bonkers.
There were snitch lines and hundreds of thousands of reports to snitch lines. Our memories are not that short. Mm. This report may be well meant and be trying to tackle some important issues, but our memories are not that short. We remember our freedoms being restricted by the government not so long ago.
Right. And that is the difficulty here, because also every time they try and kind of make a delineation between what you can do and what you can't do, they can't find the line because nobody knows where it is and everybody thinks it's different. Yeah. You know, is it OK, for example, for Just Stop Oil and the pro-Palestinian lot to barricade the British Museum because they've got a common cause that they both hate, BP, nobody can go in and watch? You know, that's intimidating, isn't it?
Well, yeah, of course, but I find it incredible that people think that the best... Like, the government, who I think are terrible at doing most things, I find the government to be perfectly incompetent. I mean... I don't understand why something that I think is so central to society, which is free speech and our freedom to be able to express ourselves without fearing for our jobs or our livelihoods or our loved ones being attacked and all of that, is best handled by the government that can't organise a picnic.
No.
I mean, I think it's ludicrous. I do think we should be having this conversation, but I think it should be on a cultural level. And if you're going to have this conversation, the government should grow a pair and say, actually, there's some people in this society that are not following the rules, that are not adopting British values, and that is the fundamental issue here.
Yes.
This is existential.
But the trouble is, I think they can't, Laura, can they? They don't know where that line is, and I don't think any of us could probably agree on where it is. Could we?
I feel
that my freedom is restricted by not even feeling quite able to discuss things as clearly as we should. And that's the truth of it. We're all self-censoring all of the time. We all know there are certain things we're supposed to say and not say. Now, according to that report, that makes me some kind of victim that needs protecting. But actually, this culture of feeling like you have to self-censor is created very deliberately by things that the government does.
There's a lot of people yapping now, aren't there? I mean, I don't know when you started doing your stand-up, but, you know, there's literally this kind of noise all the time. Yap, 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 yap. You know, you put anything on Twitter, yap, 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 yap. Look at him, he's a bigot, yap, yap, yap. I mean, it's ridiculous. You can't say anything now without somebody going, you shouldn't have said that. Oh, my God, you shouldn't have said that. That's illegal.
I don't think that's a new thing. Like, when I meet my partner's parents for the first time, I'm not going to talk about, like, BSM or anything like that. Of
BSM,
course,
BSM, motoring
center...
school. What?
BDSM, like 50 shades of stuff. But you always
BDSM. Is that an
important
thing?
BSM is British Motoring School.
They don't like talking about driving. All right, so that's
it's
a very
painful
topic. You know what I mean? Like, if I'm talking to an old lady on a bus stop, I'm probably not going to open up with like, let's chat about Palestine, love. Like, you know what I mean? You self-centre.
I wouldn't do that with anyone at the moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Because we've always self-centred.
Yeah, but that's what happens. But that's what happens on social media, and they're talking a lot about social media, and I used to say you'll never get this in real life, but now you are getting it in real life. You are now getting people shouting at each other in the street in the same way that they used to just do on Twitter, and I think that's the problem.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think there's a general degradation of discourse and standards of
and
behavior,
she talks about
and it's
everywhere, and that's where we are.
Well, because we're not socialized as we were in the past, and I think maybe social media and lockdown has a role to play in this. Because I knew growing up, there's certain things people wouldn't say to your face because they could get punched.
Right.
Now with social media, the risk of getting punched has basically vanished.
It's diminished.
So
yeah.
People say whatever they want, and unfortunately, that's given people false confidence to allow that to trickle down into real life. And then unfortunately, there will be a backlash because in real life, someone can knock your teeth out.
Right. And that's what's beginning to happen. And there's an awful lot of fighting going on.
Yeah.
You look around and maybe, again, because it's more obvious on social media, people are sort of having fights in restaurants. They're having fights at Crufts. They have
Where
a fight.
Where is the love?
You know, people have lost respect, I think, for each other. I don't know.
Wait,
someone
had a fight at Crufts?
There was a fight at Crufts because like, people from PETA turned up because they don't like dog breeders breeding dogs, which is literally what they do. I don't know. But it wasn't something that was solved peacefully. There were people punching each other, dragging each other out, and it's like it's a dog show.
Where is the love, as Black Eyed Peas said?
Maybe I've just turned into an old hippie.
I don't think violence is new. I'm just going to check it out. I think there have always been fights.
There have always been fights, but I think the atmosphere has changed. We cannot deny that. People are more wary. Of course. There are people being cancelled for ridiculous things. And I think we need to change that. Unfortunately, I don't think the government is the way to do it.
No, I agree. And we're out of time at the moment. It's going to get violent. But you don't worry. Definitely coming back. I think you are going for the moment.
We're going for a fight.
Indeed. You're going to have a fight. And maybe a couple of driving lessons while you're at it. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. After the break, we discuss all things royal with the one and only Kinsey Schofield. Stay exactly where you are. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Even after the Princess of Wales's emotional announcement on Friday evening revealing her cancer treatment, the vile conspiracy theories still rage rampant online. Kate has suffered a barrage of disgusting rumours and attacks, with bullies even claiming that her video was AI-generated. Meanwhile, senior government figures now believe the madness on social media has been fueled in part by hostile states China, Russia and Iran. Let's head to LA now and chat with the host of the To Die For daily podcast, Kinsey Schofield. Kinsey, very good evening to you. Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Obviously, I've not been on here. I've not spoken to you or anybody on air since last Thursday. So Friday's news came as much of a surprise to me as it did pretty much to everybody else. And I know it was pretty upsetting to you and to many, many other people as well. I find it astonishing that despite all of that, some of this nonsense is still going on. I'm surprised on the one hand, but I'm also not, because I remember saying to you last week, I'm not even sure that no matter what happens now, that some of these idiotic and horrendous people will believe anything now.
I was surprised. Like a couple of years ago, my dad said to me something that has stuck with me. He said, you know, not everybody is smart.
Yeah.
And that is really what has been at the top of my mind throughout this entire process, because some of what we have been navigating throughout these conspiracy theories, first of all, I think it's unfortunate that I'm asked on, you know, Australian television and on Canadian television about some of this gutter gossip, like just like break this down for me. Why am I responding to something that like alligator 444763 said on Twitter?
Right.
You know, it ruins my credibility. To me, it ruins the news network's credibility that we're giving these people a platform. But I also just think that It's about clickbait. It's about people that are getting a lot of attention from this right now. Yes. They've cultivated an audience of crazies with no moral compass, and they have to feed the beast, and they have to continue to get that attention.
Right. Interestingly enough, actually, I was watching an interview with a very interesting guy whose name escapes me for the moment, but he runs a kind of a monitoring organisation for social media. He's actually British, but he runs it in the US. And he was saying that the way that the algorithms of Twitter and Facebook but TikTok and various other things work is that they kind of publish the most outrageous things in almost every regard, not just on royal stories, but on all stories, because those are the things that get the most clicks. Those are the things that are then churned into a bigger algorithm, leading you into more of the kind of strange stuff, because in the end, people may not actually even believe what they're reading, but it gets pushed to the top of the agenda all the time. And he said that these companies could stop that, they could change the way that works, but they won't.
No, because that keeps you on their platform longer.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. When people have said, what lesson can we learn from this? I have said, stop sharing. Yeah. Don't fight in the comment section when you know that something's not true. Report it if need be. Move on. Don't watch the entire thing. Because when you fight in the comment section, when you share it with a girlfriend, when you share it with somebody like me to say, oh my gosh, is this true? Or right. Can you believe they have the audacity of saying something so salacious, what you've done is you've told Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, whatever, that this is controversial. And controversy keeps people on the site, keeps people engaged. Mm. And that is their only objective. They don't care if it's harmful towards the person. They don't care if it's true or false. All they care about is keeping you locked in so that they can go to their advertisers and not only sell your personal data, but convince them that you spend a significant amount of time on their platform so they should advertise with them.
Absolutely right. Back in the real world, meanwhile, because I don't want to spend too much time on these bozos, Easter's coming up this weekend, obviously, and that's normally a big weekend for the royal family, but clearly it's going to be a very much depleted family this weekend. Charles, obviously, still getting his treatment and still dealing with his problems, but possibly, I mean, do you think we might see Andrew out there again and obviously Edward and Anne and possibly Queen Camilla?
Well, Peter Phillips did talk to Sky Australia over the weekend, and he said that King Charles has been frustrated by, the fact that his treatment is taking a little bit longer than he'd like, and that King Charles has been so eager to get back to work, even if it is maybe not greeting everybody at Easter, but showing up and having a presence there and waving from a distance. So I do think we could potentially see King Charles over the Easter holiday, especially, I mean, I know that what Catherine is going through is preventative treatment, but with Catherine being such an important member of the royal family and so sincerely loved, a lot of people are in mourning over the fact that she's even having to go through this process with small children, with all of these nasty things being said about her online. I think the king understands that it would be a pick-me-up to show up and be seen and smiling and looking happy and as happy and healthy as he possibly can. But you're right. If he's advised not to do that by his doctors, who he's listening to, that would be perhaps another Prince Andrew running the show scenario.
Yes, exactly right. Unfortunately, we haven't got time to talk about Harry and Meghan, but maybe that's a good thing on this particular occasion.
Unfortunately.
Sorry about that. But listen, Kinsey, great to see you. Thank you so much. Lovely to talk to you as ever. Kinsey Schofield there, host of the To Die For podcast and somebody that you should absolutely follow on social media for what's really going on. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Up next, the illegal boats crisis worsens as an increasing number of small boats are now entering the UK from Vietnam, warns the government. We'll see you after the break. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, it's time for Taking the Mic. It's time for another chapter in the ever-extending volume of my collected works entitled I Told You So, and I've been telling you so for a very long time. Britain is at a dangerous junction in its history. Not since the Second World War has the nation faced such a difficult and treacherous problem. And never has its solving been more important to our continued survival as a civilised nation. These are not just words I'm speaking. These are not just empty words I'm speaking to you. These are meaningful and important words. These are meaningful and important times we're living through, and now is no time to be neutral, no time to be non-committal, because that is how we got here. 3 years ago, protests outside a school in Batley over the showing of a cartoon of the Islamic prophet Muhammad to children led to a teacher going into hiding. The teacher has a family. They are also in hiding, and they remain in hiding in fear for their lives. They are still afraid to be seen in public for fear of what might happen. No politician has campaigned on behalf of the teacher. No union has protected the teacher. And yet the will of the mob remains the fundamental reason the teacher must remain unnamed and unaccounted for. And let us not forget who the mob is in this instance. Extremist Muslims interfering in the schooling of our children. Today, a report inspired by this dreadful situation was published by Dame Sarah Khan, the Prime Minister's independent advisor on social cohesion. It found that three-quarters of people are self-censoring because they fear a new form of harassment that is corroding the social fabric of our nation, and it is threatening our democratic freedoms. This country has been a beacon of free speech and freedom of thought for centuries, but no more. Dame Khan's report says there is a shockingly widespread nature of threats and intimidation which is poisoning the lifeblood of institutions and creating a pervasively censorious culture antithetical to our democratic way of life. In other words, we're being shut down by the wokists, by the Islamists and by the mob in all sorts of forms. Aggressive harassment of public figures, both online and in our streets, is now considered the norm. Just the Boyle think nothing of going after MPs at their homes. Pro-Palestine protesters are happy to intimidate politicians and members of the public wherever they see fit. Jewish people are already being targeted in all sorts of ways. And even the British Museum was forced to close over the weekend thanks to the combined efforts of dangerous left-wing anarchists and ideologues. Dame Khan is calling for a cessation to it now. She wants buffer zones around schools to stop mobs from intimidating teachers and children. The teacher's life was ruined, but no crime was committed by the mob who ruined it. She says this must change. And she's right. This mad cancel culture must be stopped before it does any more damage. People must be allowed to speak their minds and explore ideas. Silence is never right, and never should it be. Of course, there can and must be consequences for dangerous and irresponsible ideas being promulgated for reasons of intimidation and hatred. Here at the Independent Republic, we don't shirk from that. Speak your mind, make your argument, do so with clarity, with responsibility, and above all, with intelligence, because this country deserves a whole lot better than mob rule. Now, as illegal migrants continue to raid our shores, it is no surprise the people running the entire operation are branching out. The Home Office has now discovered a rise in illegal migrants coming from, of all places, Vietnam. The government has launched an ad campaign in Vietnam where, in a bizarre paradox, it's telling the truth to potential immigrants that Britain is an overcrowded, bankrupt and broken island. Finally, they've got it. Joining me from Vienna is former UKIP leader Henry Bolton. Henry, a very good evening to you. Very much appreciate you joining us from so far away. This is a strange one. I mean, we've previously seen Vietnamese people trafficking going on sort of on lorries. We had that terrible case, didn't we, that came in, into the British Isles, if you like, via Ireland, came over from Belfast, ended up somewhere in Essex, where, unfortunately, all of the people in the back of the lorry were dead. Many of them, I think, most of them had come from Vietnam. What's going on? Surely the trip from Vietnam is a long one.
Yes, Mike. I mean, they haven't come by boat all the way from Vietnam, of course. But no, what happens, the way that this works, there's not one group that moves these people all the way from Vietnam to the UK. What happens is that they enter back in Vietnam, they enter a people smuggling facilitation, if you like. Then they're taken a certain, or that movement is facilitated for a certain distance, maybe to the border or to another country, where they are given a telephone call. This is a classic sort of methodology. Mm. Given a telephone number to call when they get there. They call that number. They haven't really got a clue where they are. Somebody then collects them, takes them on to the next stage. So it's not one organised crime network or people smuggling network that moves them all the way from Vietnam all the way to the UK. But there are many stages, and people make money out of them at every stage. And the government, this Home Office campaign, is correctly saying, well, you know, you're being lied to. But in doing that, surely the Home Office is recognising, even if it doesn't realise it, it's recognising that the migrants are actually being lied to. A deterrent, therefore, won't work. They probably don't even know what country they're going towards. They may be told they're going to Europe. They get to Europe and they're just past somebody else who's just going to exploit them and try and make money out of them to take them to the UK, another $3,000 or whatever to cross the channel. But the government is kind of acknowledging in this that the people smugglers are the people driving this process, but we're not going after them. The government with Rwanda talks about deterring the migrants. No, you've got to deter the people smugglers, the people who are marketing this movement, the people who are facilitating it and making it happen. Those are the people you've got to go after. And the only way of stopping them is upping the risk. If they feel that it's an unacceptable risk to be smuggling people, they will stop. If they believe they're going to get caught and they're going to get seriously punished. And that's not happening. We're not going after
But the trouble is, Henry, are we not in a similar situation as we are now with the drug gangs? And many of them overlap in any event, because we know that many of the people smugglers are also smuggling drugs. I'm told it's actually more lucrative now to smuggle people than it is to smuggle drugs. And let's face it, I mean, the penalties for drug smuggling are pretty hefty. I just wonder if the business is so lucrative now that they won't stop doing it. And let me just ask you another question, because only this day I was reading a story about ISIS-K, this new form of ISIS, which is responsible supposedly for what happened in Moscow over the weekend. Talk of reprisals from them against Russia, but possibly in Western Europe. Talk of Emmanuel Macron being very concerned. Unbelievably, I saw that, I think it was James Cleverly, who said, we will not allow these terrorists to enter Britain, because we're going to put our high alerts on all the ports. I mean, where does he think these people are coming from? They're not coming on the ferry. They're coming on dinghies because nobody knows who they are.
This is utterly naive. We've had a conversation like this before, Mike. I was involved in an operation in which we detected four people who were working for an Islamist terrorist organisation who were infiltrated into a people smuggling network as migrants. And they then ended up being moved to, through that people smuggling network, to Norway. They were facilitated with or provided with Norwegian driving licenses, ID cards and passports en route. You know, it happens. There is no way that James Cleverly or the Home Office or anybody else knows precisely who these people crossing the channel are. And if you let any of them in, you are potentially letting in a terrorist. We know that. The government knows that. The intelligence agencies know that. This is a matter of national security, and it's a matter of choice. Now, I'm not saying that they're all terrorists. No. That's not the case.
Well, it doesn't matter, though. There's thousands of them. Only two or three have to be terrorists.
Correct. Only one needs to be a terrorist, Mike. And we've got previous occasions where asylum seekers in this country and in mainland Europe have committed terrorist attacks. The four that I mentioned were actually not themselves going to commit terrorist attacks, but they were their task, what they'd been sort of recruited to do, was to recruit indigenous people, if you like, sort of vulnerable people in Scandinavia.
Absolutely. Listen, Henry, I've got to stop you. Sorry to cut you short, but I'm afraid we're out of time. We'll get you back on again. Enjoy Vienna. It's a great town.
Sure.
You are watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. After the break, Joe Biden brings a bit of sarcasm to his Twitter over Donald Trump's tricky week. But is it really him writing them? Unlikely. We're asking all the right questions right here. Stay tuned.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together.
J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk. We're on TV, on radio, we're online, and of course, we're on your smart speaker as well. Coming up, a last-minute lifeline for Donald Trump as his civil fraud bonds been cut by 68% to just $175 million. They'll try just about anything to stop him. And Britain, of course, to power up Britain. The nation's finally weaning off the Russian stuff as the Prime Minister dishes out £200 million to revive nuclear power. Plus, ULEZ vigilantes have found another way to fight back against Sadiq Khan's tyranny. Now, speaking of which, if you're a motorist in this country, you might be forgiven for thinking that you are very much in a persecuted majority. You're charged more than everyone else to travel into cities, hit with higher parking fees everywhere you go, forced to sit in traffic jams while empty cycle lanes are all around you, and punished with severe financial penalties for breaching any number of mad new regulations. Sadly, you'd be right on all of the above. Driving a car these days is akin to having an accident waiting to happen. And if you're feeling it in your bank balance more than ever, don't be surprised. The latest convert to the cause of anti-motorist rhetoric is Oxford Council. Green campaigners there want to hit diesel car drivers with heftier parking charges to dissuade them from coming into the city. They're arguing that because big SUVs and 4x4s, largely diesel, are bigger and heavier, they're more likely to cause injury and death, and they're more likely to damage the roads. But the Green councillors are in for a bit of a shock, I'm afraid, because some of the heaviest and biggest vehicles on the road these days are actually electric ones. And when they find out, the collective squeals will be a delight to hear. Of course, it hasn't been a very good year for EVs. First, they're being blamed for a whole series of spontaneous and toxic fires from buses to cars. Then it was revealed that some financial companies are refusing to insure them. Now, manufacturers have been banned from calling them zero-emission vehicles because it's simply not true. Well, today, I'm afraid, there is worse to come. Another rogue electric Jaguar has hit the news after reversing into a Porsche in a car park before shooting forwards and trashing a Tesla and a Mercedes. The demolition derby happened in a car park at Bournemouth railway station, where business owner Andrew Kay was shocked to see his £47,000 Jaguar E-Pace take on a mind of its own. The resulting minute or so of madness left £150,000 worth of damage to four cars, and it was a miracle that no one was injured. Jaguar insists there was nothing wrong with their car, and it must have been driver error, which Mr. Kay disputes. But this is not the first time it's happened. It's the third report this year, all of which Jaguar say are the result of mistakes by the drivers. Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? Whatever the truth is, it is very clear the gloss has gone off electric cars, sales are down, costs are rising, and the public have seen through the electric vehicle revolution. Meanwhile, the burghers of our towns remain in the dark ages. They think it's the car that is the enemy of progress. They could not be more wrong. May the 4th be with you. Now, later on in the show, we'll be bringing you a first look at tomorrow's front pages. But before anyone else, we've got an exclusive look at the inside page from the Sun newspaper. And there's obviously a theme developing here, because this is all about cars as well. And this is in the wake of course, Top Gear being cancelled only towards the back end of last year. Apparently, Paddy McGuinness and Chris Harris are getting back in the TV driving seat together just 4 months after Top Gear was shelved, partly as a result of a terrible crash that happened with Freddie Flintoff during the filming of the show in 2022. Now, the new programme is all about Chris and Paddy going on a road trip, driving around Europe and trying to look for adventures. Now, apparently, that's got nothing to do with Top Gear, according to these guys. Doesn't sound anything like it, does it? Absolute rubbish. They say, no, it's called Chris and Paddy Road Trip. They head out on the highway for a turbocharged adventure around Europe, but they will use different travel modes and they will try to find the secret of wellness and happiness. But there won't be any stunts, there won't be any car reviews, and they presumably won't be able to mention anything that they would have said during Top Gear. The headline, of course, says, second gear, no Freddie Flintoff, no car stunts, Chris and Paddy in a new show. Doesn't sound very new to me, I'm afraid. Well, more of that and more from the papers coming up a little bit later on when the panel returns, of course, later on this hour. But let's talk about what's going on in America. Because Donald Trump has been granted some reprieve today as an appeals court drastically cut the $454 million bond he was required to post in his New York civil fraud case on Monday. A five-judge panel reduced the massive amount to $175 million and gave Trump 10 days to come up with the funds. Let's go right over there now to the US of A and speak to our man, Fox News contributor, Joe Concha. Joe, very good evening to you. Welcome back to the Independent Republic.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Yeah, good. I mean, this was always going to happen, wasn't it? They were always going to water down the amount, which was so ridiculous as to be laughable. But, I mean, $175 million is still a reasonable amount of money. I presume that, at this point, he will find it.
Imagine living in a world where you are told you only have to pay $175 million of a fine, and that's considered a good day, right? So it just shows you how egregious this original number was, completely arbitrary, out of thin air, nearly 500 million people. And this whole case has been an absolute crock, Mike. I mean, the judge in this case believes that Mar-a-Lago, for example, one of the most opulent, famous properties in the world, the second largest mansion in the state of Florida, 126 rooms, plus property on the ocean, Palm Beach, is only worth $18 million, and Donald Trump inflated its value. I mean, real estate agents in the area say that property would easily go for $300-400 million. So this original fine, completely out of context. How did they expect Trump to come up with $500 million in 30 days? This is clearly election interference, meant to hurt the odds-on favorite to win the presidency. And once again, Donald Trump, he's probably going to be able to pay this. He says he will. And this looks horrible for Letitia James, the attorney general that brought this about, because it looks so political.
Well, it does, because in almost any other case, whether it was you, me, Donald Trump, whoever it was, when you're up in front of a civil judge and you're supposed to make a penalty payment of any kind, even if you're up against a criminal judge, you're always given time to pay it. The idea that they're going to go, you know, if you haven't got this money in 10 days, we're going to lock you up on Rikers Island and you'll never see, you know, light the daylight again. It's just nonsense. It's just pandering, isn't it, to the Democrats? It's just making out that they can control a man who they clearly cannot control.
Precisely. Because, Mike, look at it this way. Trump is going to appeal this case, and he was told, nope, you got to pay this even before the appeal is heard. And many legal experts here in the U.S. say that if this does get to an appeals court, a sane and sober one anyway, then this will likely be overturned or drastically reduced, because this is basically a murder case without a body, right? No banks said that they were frauded. There were no victims. And the fact that this fine was reduced by $300 million just shows you how ridiculous it is. But beyond Trump, let me give you a big picture consequence of all of this. As far as businesses fleeing New York because they see what the attorney general is doing to somebody like Trump, which should scare any company, any real estate company, any company for that matter. Did you know that 160 Wall Street firms have moved out of New York in the past 5 years? 160, that's $1 trillion in assets with them. And Alvin Bragg, Letitia James, that's the district attorney, attorney general, they're concentrating on these endeavors. Meanwhile, it's scary to take the subway now. You have subway murders are surging. Crime is up 50% in New York City transit hubs. That should be the priorities for the attorney general, the Manhattan district attorney. But instead, it's these political hit jobs, the weaponization of the justice system. That's where they're getting their marching orders from now. I'm from the Biden White House.
This is closer to my heart than you know, because I'm coming over to the U.S. actually, you know, later this week, and I'm going to spend some time in New York in the city. And, you know, I used to live there. I used to live on East 30th Street between 2nd and 3rd in Kips Bay, it was called. And, you know, a beautiful part of town. But central Manhattan, I'm told, at night now is quite dangerous. And I'm going to check into a hotel with my kids in Midtown. And I'm thinking, I don't, one, know whether there's any migrants staying anywhere nearby or whether the streets are going to be safe at night after dark or whether I can take them into kind of, you know, anywhere near Times Square or any of the places that I would normally go, you know, if it's that bad.
It's a shame, right? Because I used to live in New York myself, 96, in Columbus. And I was single. I'd go out with my friends. It would be 2 o'clock in the morning. And I didn't even think twice to look behind me, because that was under Giuliani and then eventually Michael Bloomberg. So we had 5 straight terms of, you know, you felt like you were one of the safest places around. And now you think twice about taking the subway. I mean, think about that. So that's where we are at this point. And I hope you're safe when you're here, but be sure to have a mask for your kids. And I don't mean for COVID. I mean, everything smells like weed. It stinks. There's bodies everywhere. Yeah. It's not the same city that you live in. That's certainly
for I predate you slightly, Joe. I was there in the days of David Dinkins, and it was pretty bad then. It was one of the reasons I came back to live in Britain. But anyway, we'll be fine, I'm sure. Let's talk about a little bit of banter that's been going on. Kamala Harris, first of all, roasted after she did something ridiculous. I think we might have a clip, but I'll wait and see whether we do. This was her clapping along to a protest song, and we do have it. Let's have a look.
All right.
Now, you can see her assistant to her right explains to her as she's clapping there that actually these people are, in fact, demonstrating and clapping and banging drums against you. And it's actually, you know, a demonstration of a protest song. And then she suddenly stops clapping and realises that maybe that's not a very good idea. She keeps trying to kind of make herself relevant. She did it again the other day where she said she's looked at some maps and she's now pretty sure why there should be a ceasefire in Gaza. You know, she's not really helping herself here, is she?
Oh, no. I mean, you just witnessed exhibit, you know, Z, as far as why Kamala Harris is the most unpopular vice president in polling history.
Yeah.
She's more unpopular than Dick Cheney. You know, this is a guy who led us into a war under false pretenses and literally shot a guy in the face. And she's still more unpopular than him. So if you're Joe Biden, the problem is you can't get rid of her because then you're going to alienate some voters of color. But if you keep her, then this is the package that you get. And if I'm Donald Trump, I run on this all day. I say, hey, this is the backup plan in case Joe Biden were to step down or otherwise. That's your president right there, and that should be a scary thought for even Democrats, quite frankly.
And that has got to be Joe Biden's Achilles heel, no matter what, because, you know, he can't guarantee that he's going to be able to run a campaign, never mind get into power and stay there for 4 years. There's no way he can make that promise. But the other thing that was funny today, I thought, was Donald Trump's tweet about how he was going to be at Trump International Golf Club in West Palm Beach to receive an award. Not one, but two awards for the Club Championship Trophy and the Senior Club Championship Trophy. He won both of them. I mean, it's a very Trump-esque thing to say. Joe Biden thought he would make a bit of fun with it. And I'm not sure if we've got this tweet, but he goes, "Congratulations, Donald. Quite the accomplishment." You can see the old liberal elite sneering away at this, but ordinary people, golfers, people who are quite like Donald Trump will rather like it, won't they?
Of course. I mean, look, can Joe Biden even finish a hole, right? Because he could barely walk at this point. He has to have special sneakers. They have shorter steps just for him to get up to Air Force One. So, yeah, the fact that Donald Trump's 77 years old and he's basically shooting his age, I can tell you as a golfer, that's pretty good. I mean, I shot 81 yesterday, but that was only on the front nine, Mike. It didn't go well for me at all. I used a lot of foot wedges and it didn't matter.
Excellent. I used to play a lot of golf in the Delaware Gap in the good old days when I was living there, driving across Jersey. But one final one for you, Joe, and it's a developing story because there's a couple of resignations going on in the Israeli cabinet tonight, which may or may not have some kind of knock-on effect to Netanyahu's ability to stay in charge of the government right there. But also, he's now cancelled an Israeli diplomatic trip to Washington, which was due to take place over the next few days because the US today refused to veto the United Nations resolution calling for a Gaza ceasefire. Does this change anything?
Oh, well, I think what's changed as far as the Biden administration and now suddenly Netanyahu is more the enemy than Hamas is the fact that Joe Biden is trailing in the state of Michigan, which has a large Muslim population. Joe Biden had a primary there recently where 100,000 people wrote in uncommitted as opposed to voting for Joe Biden. So if he loses Michigan, he loses the election is the way this is going to go. So that's why now Netanyahu is not coming because he doesn't feel very welcome, quite frankly, by Democrats, U.S. lawmakers. And this ceasefire here only will strengthen Hamas before Israel can finish the job. So I shudder to think what the next couple of months are going to be like.
And, of course, this is the same guy who said that there was a peace deal on the table and he was hopeful that it would be kicking in before the start of Ramadan, which is now over a week ago, isn't it?
Yeah, and he was holding an ice cream cone with Seth Meyers while doing that, just so you could take him completely seriously in these situations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Grown men get ice cream with other grown men all the time, apparently.
Yeah, really. Apparently so. I mean, I loved how people were trying to make out that that was completely normal. He was trying to reach out to a younger audience. What, four-year-olds? I mean, you know, doesn't he know they can't vote? Absolutely incredible stuff. Joe, good to see you. Thank you very much indeed. Joe Concha reporting into us there from Fox News on the latest that's going on between the US of A and Israel. Now, back in Blighty, we're witnessing a bit of a renaissance in the nuclear industry, according to the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. Earlier today, he announced a £200 million package to help revive nuclear power in this country. Joining me now is Director of the Nuclear Information Service, David Cullen. David, a very good evening to you.
Hi, how are you doing, Mike?
I'm hopeful that you're going to tell me that this is a great plan and it's all going to be tickety-boo and before you know it, we're going to have loads of nuclear plants powering our very, very expensive electricity. But I'm not absolutely convinced. So please tell me, what do you make of it?
I was really surprised, to be honest with you. I mean, to be clear, my organisation looks more at nuclear weapons. This announcement is quite interesting in that it talks about the links between the two of them. Yeah. And there's obviously an intent to support both of them at the same time. But if we're talking about nuclear weapons, and I think they were up in Barrow, there's a lot of evidence of really significant mounting problems in the production of the new submarines, massive financial black holes, and the money that's been announced, obviously, it's a lot of money, but not in governmental standards, and it's tiny compared to the massive black holes we're seeing.
Right.
You know, the MOD's own figures say that their equipment plan over the next 10 years has got a £17 billion black hole, and that nuclear spending, the MOD's nuclear spending, has got at least an £8 billion black hole over the next 10 years. And with, you know, the government's talking about £20 million a year. It's tiny in comparison.
Well, that's the trouble. Because whenever I see numbers like 200 million, you just know that it's not really going to go very far. Because unless you're talking billions in anything now that we do, you know, it doesn't really even touch the size, does it? But, I mean, the other problem with this is that in defence particularly, they haven't got the basics, have they? I mean, we only saw Grant Shapps on that ship over in Florida a few short weeks ago test firing a missile, which obviously wasn't a nuclear missile, but, you know, could be in the future. Didn't even get off the ground, literally, sort of made it to the top of the surface, went up in the air, and almost came back down on top of them. You know, and then, of course, they said, well, that's all right, because if it was a real missile, it would work. And you kind of go in, how do you work that one out then, exactly?
I don't think they know why that went wrong, Mike, honestly. No. It takes time to look, you know, the missile went to the bottom of the sea and they fished it out. And like 2 weeks later, they're off the record claiming that it was something to do with something was added for the test. But that's almost certainly not the case. They probably don't even know yet. They need to take the thing apart and look at it.
Yeah. And I know that this is not your area of expertise, but I mean, the nuclear industry as such is not just about nuclear weapons. Surely it should also be about using nuclear power. But they try to kind of pretend that one is quite separate from another, but surely it's not, is it?
No, there's a lot of linkages between the two. I mean, in the past, they were just one industry. And as time went on, it became politically uncomfortable for them to talk about how the two support each other. And for a long time, there was this claim that they had nothing to do with each other. This announcement today, like I said, is quite interesting because they're starting to talk about the linkages between the two. They're starting to talk about the skills work they're doing that will train up people that could work in either defence or power. But yeah, it's less interlinked than it used to be in the past, but it's still very closely linked.
And as far as the sort of the nuclear business around the world is concerned, you know, we hear an awful lot about how we have to stop Iran from getting their hands on a nuclear weapon. We're not sure exactly what the state of Russia's nuclear arsenal and armoury is. You may be able to tell me more about that than I know, but what is the state of sort of nuclear Armageddon, if you like? I mean, how many weapons and how many missiles are still pointing at one another?
There's, I think, something in the region of about 14,000 weapons globally. That's been, it's been going down and it's just starting to climb again, is my understanding. I think we're in a bit of a less dicey situation than right at the start of the Ukraine war when people didn't know where everybody's red lines were. But it's still very problematic and the outlook for the future is very poor. All of the major nuclear weapon states are building more weapons. You mentioned Russia. They're investing in a lot of capabilities that may or may not work, but are destabilizing at the very least. And although there aren't any states who we think, with the possible exception of Iran, are likely to develop nuclear weapons in the near future, it's still a concern that the international regime that has kept proliferation so low has is under such threat because of dissatisfaction with it, because of the upgrades that are happening.
Right. And the one time we do hear about nuclear weapons possibly being utilised very much in the Russia-Ukraine theatre is the tactical type of nuclear weapons. I mean, I've spoken to military experts who say, well, there really isn't any such thing. You know, nuclear weapon is a nuclear weapon. Tactical really doesn't mean that it's necessarily any better or preferable.
No. When people talk about tactical weapons, to be clear, they're talking about things that are several times larger than the Hiroshima bomb.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unimaginable destruction, for sure.
You know, that's the tactic to basically wipe everybody out. So, I mean, is there evidence that there's more of those available to Putin?
I don't think he's increasing those numbers, no. And the changes that have happened have been in rhetoric and in them developing new capabilities. So there's the nuclear armed, brain's gone.
No, it happens.
The underwater, self-propelled, the self-propelled nuclear weapon.
Well, the drones.
Stuff like that, that kind of thing, and anti-satellite stuff. So it's more developing new things. They've got a bilateral treaty with the US that keeps the numbers of the large ones static, and that's in place for the next couple of years, but there's no negotiations to extend it, which is a major worry.
Right.
I think after that ends, we might see more increases in numbers.
Right. And I mean, just to go back once again to the nuclear energy side of things, I mean, is there any evidence that the government wants to... I mean, there's no evidence that they'll even be here after about 6 months, but is there any evidence that they might want to increase the number of nuclear reactors currently, usable that we have and actually build more and make more use of it?
They keep talking about it. They keep saying that that's a major part of their energy strategy. The trouble is that the one that we're building at the moment is taking a very long time and costing loads more money, and nobody wants to put their hand in their pockets for the kinds of sums that would need to be in place to really upscale nuclear reactors. And that's the same with both the government and with Labour. Both of them are talking a good game, but no one's fronting any money for it. Well, not any money. They're not fronting enough money. You know, they're a bit like the announcement today. They're putting forward millions when we really need to be talking billions if that's what they want to do.
Yeah. And, I mean, obviously, we should, I suppose, ask the question, what would Labour do? You know, they've got a sort of checkered history, haven't they, with the nuclear power and nuclear weapons. There was a time when they wanted complete nuclear disarmament. I'm assuming Keir Starmer doesn't talk about that anymore.
No, I mean, their policy in both power and weapons is very much the same as the government's. They say they'll keep the capabilities we currently have. They say they'll fund them. In both cases, there are real questions over whether the amount of money is going to be forthcoming for it. You know, both are committed on paper to keeping things as they are. Neither appears to be properly coming up with the sums of money that are required to keep things as they are.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, listen, interesting. It's fascinating to see where it's all going to go. David, thanks very much indeed. David Cullen, Director of the Nuclear Information Service, who's not sure that 200 million quid is going to go very far when it comes to nuclear weapons. He probably is quite right to say that nobody's really sure where the new nuclear reactors are going to be built. Did we not, in my darkest distant memory, remember that there was a time when Boris Johnson promised loads of little small nuclear devices, nuclear power stations, that we were going to have these little microbursts of nuclear energy at the end of your street and you'd be able to have cheaper energy? I'm sure I remember that. I'm sure I didn't dream it. I'm sure it did actually happen. Did it? You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. After the break, my panel returns with me. We've got Shemima Begum losing her legal case, the Tory party exodus, and meagre Ramonas. Do not go anywhere. Now, if you thought the Ramonas had gone away, you've got another think coming, because the puerile keyboard warriors that love to say Britain wants to rejoin the EU have been dealt yet another massive blow by their own demonstration. After quoting polls from spurious research bodies, you'd think the dial was shifting and there really was an appetite to rejoin. And as our video shows, it was a minute gaggle of woke wombles. Have a look at this.
Shout a little louder.
I'm not even sure there's enough of them to actually call it a plural gathering, to be honest. But if you watch carefully, there's a guy on the left you might remember called Femi Oluwela, who was up there. You know, apparently we're told all the time by YouGov whenever they do these surveys, oh, you know, 65, 70% of people want to rejoin. That guy who's got the Sainsbury's bag. Can we have another look at it, actually? Because I wouldn't mind studying it a bit more. The guy carrying the Sainsbury's bag on the far right, if you'll pardon the phrase, appears to have everybody's lunch with him. Have a look. There's Femi on the left. See him? He's had to go round the pole. There's literally about 12 of them. This is in Liverpool, apparently. Now, let's see the guy on the right. He's got lunch. I mean, what can you say about these morons?
Not a high priority in Liverpool, is it?
Doesn't seem to be.
They look like a funny little cult in those numbers.
They really do.
It's not a good look.
It's a shame, isn't it? That,
well, I mean, I think you could make a stronger argument if you say Brexit has failed and the EU is doing great. The EU is also not doing great.
Well, even if you wanted to make any kind of argument, you know, sitting around with these kind of people and shouting, we are rejoiners. I mean, what is it? Sounds like something out of the Diddy Men. Ken Dodd.
Problem here is you've made it too enticing because now you call them woke wombles.
Yeah.
I would happily be a woke womble.
Well, you would, yeah.
I'd love to be a woke
womble. But you're used
to
being in small crowds, aren't you, with your performance?
I mean, to be honest, that's massive than about, for me.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's a big audience for you.
That's bigger than my Edinburgh run, mate.
Wombles were woke. Don't forget they were litter pickers.
There's nothing wrong with litter pickers.
Good.
They were very, you know, they had, what was her name, Madam?
I don't think there was much diversity, was there?
Yes, there was a lady womble.
One lady. And then
actually, sort of, if we were really woke, we wouldn't be calling her a lady.
The lady.
The lady.
We don't want to assume her gender.
No.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, who knows? I mean, wombles are maybe gender neutral.
Maybe.
For all you know. Now, talking of demonstrations, though, there's a demonstration going on live. You've noticed it tonight. I've noticed it as well. There's a lot of tractors in Parliament Square. Are we going the way of the Netherlands and the way of Germany and France?
I hope so.
It says here, hashtag Farmers Lives Matter, which I love. It's great.
I love. I mean, it sounds like it could be considered racist in some quarters, but farmers' lives do matter.
They do.
You know, we talk all the time, don't we, about all the protests that are annoying, you know, the Just Stop Oil and Extinction Rebellion and all the rest, and this panoply of weird...
Animal rebellion, the ones that pour milk
environmental
out in the
ones, food
halls at Harrods.
Orange powder and milk and the rest. And finally, a protest that's put a smile on my face.
Yes.
Good on the British farmers.
But, of course, being British, they haven't done what they did in France, which is to coat everything with manure.
I was just about to say...
Or to sort of set fire to things like they did in the Netherlands.
Perfect. Yes, but you know,
they're driving
tractors.
In a very clean tractor around Parliament Square. Very British.
With the Union flag. Now, it's not often you see...
I mean, look how clean that tractor is. Like, I've got it here. That is a clean tractor.
That has not been in a field any time recently.
It's lovely. I love a tractor.
I do.
Not only are the tractors clean, they're all carrying Union flags.
Where's that guy
in here that's
out watching tractor porn? You think he's down there? Do you remember that?
When I said I love tractors, I thought you shouldn't have said that, Laura. Mike's going to remember the MP.
I just thought, what do they do with the exhaust pipe?
Yeah, well,
it's not often you see Union flags at a protest.
No.
That automatically makes it a protest
that'll
I'm
make
in favour
right of. Far right
to
the Guardian, won't it? They'll be,
a far
they'll
right
be, they'll,
protest.
They'll be a far
even
right
better.
Tractors.
In Northern Ireland, there's a lot of Union flags at a protest.
Only in certain protests.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to choose. Yes. Do you see a fair few there?
Yeah, you do.
I mean, in London.
You know, one of the times that when I realised I'd moved to Scotland was when England won the Rugby World Cup down in Australia. And it happened very early. It was very early in the morning. And I was living in Glasgow at the time. And the only thing we had to hang out the window was a Union Jack towel that somehow we'd had from the last holiday we'd been on. And you should have seen the abuse that just started. People started throwing things at the house. They were like, take that down. F the Pope or whatever it was, you know, all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's unbelievable, you know, because apparently it's a Rangers thing. You know, you have a Union flag and the Celtic people have the Irish tricolour, you know. So don't hang a Union Jack in Scotland or Northern Ireland if you don't want to.
The moral of that story is never do the washing up.
That's very true. Never watch rugby very early in the morning. Now, I've got to talk to you about the Archbishop of Canterbury because I don't know whether you've seen his tweet today, but I think we've got it. You might remember it was Palm Sunday on Sunday.
Yes.
Last Sunday passed. We're coming up to...
Yesterday, in fact.
We're coming up to Good Friday on Friday, Easter Sunday. You know, Holy Week, as some people would call it.
Yeah.
Do you know what he tweeted out today?
As all Christians would call it, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop Wokeby, as I like to call him.
Brilliant.
Today is the International Day of Remembrance of Victims of Slavery and Transatlantic Slave Trade.
Right.
He says, let us join together in solidarity for all modern victims of slavery and human trafficking, continuing to call out unjust systems and structures. Now, what's interesting about his call against the old human trafficking is he's OK with human trafficking in the modern era because he wants everybody to be brought here on dinghies and then welcomed with open arms and turned into Christians. So he's actually not against human trafficking at all, which is a bit unfortunate since it's today the Day of Remembrance of Victims of Slavery and Human Trafficking.
Did he tweet anything yesterday on Palm Sunday, I wonder?
He tweeted one thing about Palm Sunday, but I picked him up last week because his pinned tweet is not about Easter at all. Guess what it's about?
Oh, Rwanda.
Gaza. And calling for an immediate ceasefire on humanitarian grounds. There's no... You have to go quite a long way back to find anything about Easter at all. He's then got a picture of him visiting the mosque in Canterbury, which is obviously where he's the Archbishop of. But there's nothing of him visiting the cathedral in
couldn't stop my eyes widening and my eyebrow raising. But you see, last year...
I'm not picking on him, it's just he keeps picking on
himself. I think he opens himself up to it. Last year, the Church of England said, oh, we should start doing Fish Fridays again. Oh, right, OK. You know, there's a Christian purpose to that.
Yeah.
The reason they
it's
wanted
the miracle
to do...
of the five... fishes. Is it two loaves and five fishes?
Introduce Fish Fridays, meat-free Fridays, was for net zero. So they were taking something that's got an original...
Oh, what, now, you mean?
This was last year. They talked about it. So repurposing a Christian tradition for net zero.
OK.
But you can't do that.
No.
that's not what the teaching is about.
No. Well, this is when I...
And they were giving up meat for Lent for net zero. Right. But that's not why you give up things for Lent. You give up things for Lent to mirror Jesus in the desert.
Also, if you give up for Lent, that's not going to get you to net zero. Not long enough, is it?
Yeah, it's only 40 days.
Do they worship God or do they worship net zero?
Well, I said this last week because we also discovered that they invented a new sin in the Church of England. You know what it is? Racism. Racism is a new sin. And I checked back with the seven deadly sins and it's still not one of them. You know, sloth, lust, greed, all of those, the original seven deadly sins.
Yeah.
Racism isn't one of them. Wow. So I said basically it's good news for the devil because he's no longer the most evil person in the world because the most evil person in the world is a racist.
Yeah, and the king.
You see what I'm
saying? You know what, I think actually they should
I'm
make
quite
the
sad that people can't celebrate Easter here. What's wrong with it?
Who's not celebrating Easter? It's my favourite time of year.
Well, the Archbishop of Canterbury is not talking about Easter. Well, he's talking about international slave trade.
They need to bring the current Archbishop of Uganda.
It's Holy Week.
It's Holy Week.
It is Holy Week, and it's...
They need to bring the current Archbishop of Uganda and bring him and make him the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Yeah.
Because there's clearly a split within the Anglican Church. There's the Anglican Church here in the UK and everyone else. Everyone else is normal. Right? You actually have... People
yeah, Christians
stink-
in Africa well, are very happy to celebrate Christianity.
I kid you not, these people are very strange to me. I grew up as an Anglican and I'm like, getting rid of what, the anti-whiteness or whatever, I'm like, where in the Bible does it say any of this? Do you want to talk about...
Doesn't.
Love your neighbour or poverty. You're talking about anti-whiteness. Mm.
I do actually genuinely find it really sad. I was at church for Palm Sunday yesterday. And, you know, the story is quite a rich,
it's
important
a great story.
Yeah.
The donkey and everything.
In the Christian faith, but also as part
and
of our culture.
Did you get a palm?
I did. Also as part of our culture, there really is very little else he should be talking about in Holy Week.
In this one week, which is, you know, in many ways for Christians, a bigger week than every other.
Oh, it is.
Much bigger than Christmas. You know, it's the resurrection, it's the crucifixion, it's the betrayal in the, you know, the Garden of Judea. See, all of that catechism school work that I did. You know, I remember all that.
I'm surprised.
It's a shame that, you know, I'm surprised as well. It is, but it is, you know, it's changed beyond all recognition. The church has gone woke and I don't like it.
But the thing is, only the church in England has gone woke because everywhere else, I'm like...
Well,
even last year when the church... And I keep bringing this up, when the Church of England here was like, OK, we're going to bless same-sex unions in the church. And I'm like, but why? You wouldn't ask Muslims to do that.
Right.
It's against the doctrine. You don't have to be an Anglican.
Right.
But if you are going to be an Anglican, you subscribe to certain... Like, you subscribe to the church and the teachings of the church.
Yeah, no, they just changed
it. But the thing is, you had the Archbishop in Kenya and Uganda and in, I think, Nigeria and Ghana as well. And they were outraged. They were like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You're going to destroy the church. Because everywhere else, we're like, what Bible have you been reading?
Yeah, I know. It's all very weird.
When you talk about woe, though, something that I do find very funny is my mom has to get... gluten-free wafers.
Oh, really?
She's
they
Catholic.
Do those now.
Gluten-free, absolutely. And you can go to certain churches where it's... And what's funny about the
body of Christ.
It's the body... And she's Catholic, so she believes it is the body of Christ, but she has to get it gluten-free.
You can't have a gluten-free body of Christ.
Mad.
Well, so she doesn't literally believe in the transubstantiation.
I have made exactly that argument to her.
It was always gluten-free, though. It's literally like... It's unleavened
bread.
Well, no, it's not. I had communion last week. It's literally like cardboard and like.
Yeah.
There's no gluten in there.
Yeah, it's not real bread anymore.
Yeah, no.
I mean, it never was. I was actually an altar boy, so I can tell you from backstage.
Too.
Yeah, from backstage, I can tell you exactly what it was. And it used to come in little packets. And
yeah.
Very little food was involved in the making of that, I can tell you.
Yeah, no.
But what about if you're a vegan? You can't take the body of Christ?
I've said this for years. Huh? But when you think about it, like, if you are Catholic, you are actually eating a human. Like, that's not a... Like, you are actually...
Were you breastfed as a kid? Because I'm pretty sure breast milk isn't vegan.
Yeah, but I wasn't... Well, no, like, I wasn't breastfed when I'm 35.
Yes, but Dave's a vegan who eats cheese anyway,
God for that.
So that's not going to be...
there's a word for that.
Yeah.
Even that show's been banned. Let's talk about something slightly less contentious, shall we? Anti-ULES vigilantes, this is great, have now come up with an even better idea than what they were doing before. Allegedly, they were cutting down these posts and cameras and putting, you know, bags over them and all this. They've now put bat boxes up, which means they can't be touched.
Brilliant. And also, you know, this helps the ecosystem and diversity.
Very good.
So, you know,
it's like rewilding the London
Borough. So they're covering it with a bat box.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
It is brilliant, because you're not allowed to move bats.
And they just put it back on.
You're not allowed to touch it.
You can't, if there's a bat living anywhere, it could be in your loft, it could be in your house. I did not
know this.
You know, these are like same as water voles, they're protected. So by the local
council. Hold up, so I have to live with a bat that doesn't pay me rent?
Well, the bat's quite small, to be fair.
It does not pay rent.
No, it doesn't pay rent, no.
Oh, absolutely not.
I love this. This is just like, it's such a British...
It's
such
it?
A British version of the bat signal. You know, we don't need Batman. We've got real bats and biodiversity. It's so creative.
Do they have that with pigeons and not like pigeon box?
No, pigeons are not protected.
Pigeons are a scourge.
Although, I mean, I don't think you can kill them as such.
Yeah, you can't cull them.
You get falconers. Is it falconers where you get birds of prey and to kill the pigeons,
yes,
don't you, in London?
You do, yeah. But, like, for example, seagulls are protected, believe it or not.
You're not allowed to
do anything to seagulls. If you find there are seagulls nesting on your roof and every time you go out with the rubbish, they swoop down and break into it and put it all over the road, there's nothing you can do. You just have to, you know, suck it up because they are a protected species, unbelievably.
Well, we once saw a bird that was, like, not long for this earth, and we called up the RSPB because, like, it wasn't in
they
a good
be
way.
Interested.
They didn't care.
No.
I was but like, this very, is a really what, distressed animal. They're like, nah, mate.
But you know why? Because they're too busy making sure that they've got enough diversity and wokery going on inside the RSPB. They're not interested in actually saving any birds or doing their job.
I was shocked.
You can't just have anyone saving a bird. You have to have a black transgender Muslim. Can you just get with the programme?
Well, yeah, exactly right. So I think this is going to be good because, of course, the whole ULES situation, I mean, we talked earlier about Oxford is now the latest council to say that they want to charge people more money to park a car that's powered by diesel, and they've come up with this great idea that SUVs are more likely to be damaging the roads. Well, this is where the green people have finally come unstuck because the heaviest vehicles on the roads are electric vehicles.
Or tractors now.
Tractors, I think, are exempt, actually, in the same way that tanks
Seriously?
Are.
Seriously?
Yeah, because Mr. Pothole, a man who's on this show on a regular basis, goes around the country finding potholes, he got himself a tank. It's like a sort of Second World War tank, and he drove it into London because tanks are exempt from the congestion charge.
Wow.
So, you know.
But I think we should be encouraging things like this.
Do you know what happened to it? He got it halfway towards Westminster Parliament Square and it got stuck in a pothole.
Oh, no.
And the pothole was so big that he couldn't get out of it.
I love that. It's poetic justice.
Poetic justice, yeah. Absolutely right.
That's brilliant.
So you learn things on this show that you don't learn on other shows. Finally, former Tory male voters are switching to reform in droves. Mm. The Tory party are stuffed, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, there was a YouGov poll this week that's put the Tories at the lowest yet, 19%.
Yes.
Wow.
And reform, I think, are at 15%.
Yes.
So only just behind, but male voters are more likely to vote for reform than Tory now. Brexiteers, pensioners, Red Wall voters are particularly more likely to switch from Tory to reform.
Yeah.
It really looks like game over.
It does.
Tories. And I think people were trying to be quite circumspect about Lee Anderson's defection, but I think that was really unhelpful. Mm. And, of course, if Nigel Farage is to throw his hat back in the ring, it'll be a real game changer for reform points.
Oh, I think so. I don't think it's unlikely. It's inconceivable, shall we say, that the Tory party's just finished.
That's not inconceivable, but on the reform point, we need to see them actually winning seats. That's when people will start to wake up and take this seriously as not just like an anti-Tory protest party, but a party that actually has some skin in the game. Mm. I do think the polls will narrow closer to the election. But like you, I want to see the Tories obliterated because I don't think they deserve this two-party system that we have where these parties feel entitled to the British vote and so they can come into government and do whatever the hell they like. I don't think that's acceptable anymore. And I do think the Tories have lost the trust of the public.
And they're still
talking. And they deserve to be obliterated.
And they're still talking as if, you know, they know what's going on.
Well, yeah, they're completely adrift from the country.
I mean, comedy circuit, do you bother even making fun of the Tories anymore? I mean, it's a bit of an easy laugh, isn't it?
It's interesting how politics isn't really talked about that much because there's only so much satire you can do. Like, right. Bojo was very good for it because he could satire on the satire, but I think a lot of people kind of almost feel sorry for Rishi Sunak because it's like, it's too easy now. Like, it's kicking a puppy while he's down.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what the mood would be like in those meetings?
It must be horrendous.
What could he do to make it worse? I genuinely do think that.
Well, he has to wake up every morning and try and show this kind of, you know, happy face to the public. And it can't be easy, can it? I mean, I don't feel sorry for him, but, you know.
He does wake up enormously rich every morning, and I'm sure he's got some wonderful job in Santa Monica to go to afterwards. But I have to say, I don't agree that reform is just a protest vote.
I think these male voters
who are switching genuinely want to see some reform. MPs, not to say happen, but I don't think this is a protest. I think people are absolutely desperate for genuine change.
Mm. Yeah. Well, the thing is, I want to see them eat into the Labour vote as well.
Yeah.
Because you had there was a piece in the Metro talking about, you know, the reform could be dangerous for the Tory party. Mm. What about the Labour party? Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it doesn't look like a lot of their base are happy. I mean, Owen Jones leaving the Labour Party, I think, is a ringing endorsement of Keir Starmer, actually. I don't think it's to show that the Labour Party is in shambles. That being said, though, there are many disgruntled Labour voters that I think would like to reform as well.
But the Labour Party is just as, you know, divided as the Tory party are, so it's all a bit of a mess.
I think voter turnout is going to be mad. Yeah. I think it's going to be like three men and a dog.
Very low.
Like, it's just going to be... And everyone's going to be...
And the dog will be voting for reform.
I don't know. I might actually vote this year for the first time.
Did you?
In a little while.
Yeah.
No, I've always voted, but I've sport my ballot.
Right, yeah,
the last
yeah.
couple of elections. Yeah. No, most definitely deliberately. I've drawn some choice cartoons on my ballot paper.
Like what?
I remember, yes. Genitalia appeared once.
Okay.
Laura!
Men don't have... ......
Yeah.
I think I might actually cross a box this year.
Mm. That's great.
Or next year.
Well, yeah. we'll see.
We'll see.
Well... you're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up next, the very best of tomorrow's news from the papers. And also, civil servants still glued to their sofas, a revolting cost to the taxpayer. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, it's time for this.
The world of woke.
It's that time of the year again, you know, when the school holidays are upon us and the roads get just that little bit quieter because busy mums and dads aren't taking their little ones to school in the family car. Of course, you notice it a little bit less now on Mondays and Fridays these days because so many people are still working from home. Despite various clarion calls from companies who got it wrong during the COVID years, there are still a large tranche of people, particularly those that work in an office, who are still fighting calls for them to return to work. It's famously worse in the civil service. They're all going on strike soon because they've been asked to consider getting out of their pyjamas for 2 days a week and actually leaving the house. Outrageous, I know. And when they were asked how many days they would be willing to come in for on a weekly basis in a recent survey, the vast majority of civil servants said, wait for it, less than two. 2 days a week. So we're talking less than 100 days a year for mostly well-paid jobs with great perks and a brilliant pension. Is it any wonder this country is on its knees with practically zero growth and even lower productivity? Only last week, HMRC workers had to be dissuaded from pulling the plug on their tax helpline when the Chancellor suggested they might be taking the mickey slightly by switching off the phones from April the 8th until September for what was euphemistically called the summer. Well, tonight, ladies and gentlemen, I bring you more madness from the work-from-home fraternity. Thanks to a Freedom of Information request, we have discovered that Whitehall lawyers have spent nearly £4 million of our money on new laptops, tablets and mobile phones, all because they don't want to go into the office. The government's legal department, the GLD, has purchased thousands of remote working devices for its staff since 2021, including 560 mobile phones, 2,135 new laptops and 10 tablet computers, according to data that's just been released. And that has all cost taxpayers £4 million. Marvellous, isn't it? The GLD is the government's principal legal advisor. They opened an office in Manchester just last year, but they appear to be having trouble getting anyone to go into it. They employ 2,500 lawyers who work on government policies. To be honest, if they're the ones drafting the Rwanda plan, we might as well fire them all now. Of course, the staff complain that they would rather work from home because they're happier, healthier and more productive. Well, of course they're going to say that. The true cost of this mammoth mistake will be felt for generations. I only hope we haven't run out of money by the time someone works out just how much it's wrecking everything we do. But that is the world of work.
The world of woke.
Imagine £4 million wasted on all these computers.
Well, how do they measure that they're more productive? Because I thought it was notoriously difficult to even get fired as a civil servant.
Well, this is the trouble. I mean, everybody who works from home, I've been having these arguments with them ever since they were sent home to work, because I famously never went home to work. I always came in. They all say they're much happier and they're much better productive and all that, but nobody can prove it. Nobody knows.
And I do think it damaged, especially if you're a recent graduate, it's a horrible, horrible thing to start off your work life working from
it's
home.
It's not or normal having, to sit it, in it, a room it, on your own.
Well, it's not even just that. Remotely. You lose a lot of valuable socialising skills. You lose how to navigate the world of work and the politics and all of that. I think that really is detrimental. If you're like in your 50s and 60s, a couple of days a week, maybe you're freelance, fine. But on the productivity point, I really don't...
Maybe
how,
this is
how
partly...
How do civil servants prove their productivity? I'm genuinely curious.
Exactly. It's a very good point. I don't know. But maybe this is part of the reason why people are so rude to each other in real life now, because so many of them don't see anyone.
Well, yeah.
Apart from when they go on a protest march.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know? In a sense, we're in a bit of a social experiment at the moment because it's the first time we've ever communicated in a group remotely through a screen. It's a very new thing. We don't know how it's really going to affect dynamics and productivity. I can see the attraction of some flexibility. Who couldn't?
Yeah.
And maybe it's good for some people to have a bit of a blend of hybrid working. But I do think it sounds embarrassing for us as a nation that our own civil service don't want to go more than one day a week. Because in that job, I know sometimes the salaries aren't as high as those lawyers would get in the private sector, for instance. But
they're pretty high, though.
But they do have a really good package.
Right.
The pension is... tremendous.
Also, surely,
good
to goodness, if you're running...
doing a service.
Yes, also, if you're running a public service, it's not an open, purse to just go, here's some more money. You can't just spend £4 million and go, oh, yeah, you work from home, here's a new laptop, here's a new phone. You know, why should we be paying
quite
for
low. I'm just going to check it out. I thought it was going to be much higher than that.
Well, that's only one place, though. That's just the legal department. That's nothing to do with the department.
But
DEFRA, Defence, Home Office, multiply that by about a million.
But surely when they're in the office, they have to have someone on site in order to service the computer
and
to buy a desktop. No, but what I'm saying is I would be interested to know how much... Because that could even be a saving. Because when you're in the office, I'd say the costings would be even higher than
just sending... They would get it fixed by their local... there are always like these PC and laptop repair shops. I'm assuming they'd get it serviced by them and then bill it back to the civil service.
No, the point is that they have to buy government computers. Well, they should say, look, if that's a cost... then we should look at that and see if we can afford it. And if we can't afford it, we shouldn't do it. So, sorry, matey, you're afraid you have to just come into work like you used
to. It's double buying because the equipment already exists in the office. So why should you buy more equipment for someone to have the comfort of working from home? Now, listen, I'm not that fussed about it if they can prove they're being as productive, but the civil service are not known for being terribly productive.
We have zero growth in this country. We have zero productivity. There's a reason for that. Because everybody's bloody working from home. Anyway, let's talk about Shamima Begum. She couldn't join ISIS from home. Maybe she should have done.
Well, yeah, she had to go anywhere.
They don't know that.
I've decided to join ISIS, but I'm staying at home. Imagine how much easier her life would have been.
She'd have saved herself an awful lot of trouble.
Front page of the
Eye. About the Shamima Begum thing.
Yeah.
Especially with the BBC documentary that they did about her, she's never actually come out to say exactly what she did.
No.
That thought has just come to me because...
Well, there's another story that's out today.
She's 15 and all of that.
There's another story that's come out today which basically said there's a witness who said that she was involved with this kind of child slavery ring, that she was very much a knowing participant in, the kidnapping of people, the murder of people. The women who worked for ISIS were not sitting there making, tea and crumpets. They were carrying machine guns and helping their husbands kill people.
Well, the thing is, she's made the claim that she's not a threat to the UK, she can help de-radicalise people. OK, but what did you do? Just say it.
Just the fact that she went and would be allowed to
return home is the opposite of de-radicalising people. I understand the arguments that have been made that you shouldn't strip citizenship from people. Yeah. Jacob Rees-Mogg made it very eloquently, but it's impossible to muster up sympathy for this woman.
Yeah.
I know she was only 15, but we know she'd seen beheadings on video. She knew exactly what she was getting into.
Right. And also, of course, we're told constantly that 15-year-olds are more than capable of deciding to change their gender. But she can't absolutely have any idea what she was doing.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, she was only 15. I was like, how many 15-year-olds do you know that want to join ISIS?
I know.
Like, that's not an excuse.
I actually did an interview once with some woman who was defending her who said, oh, come on, Mike, we've all done stupid things as teenagers. I'm like, yeah, I didn't go and join a death cult to help murder anyone. I might have nicked a few sweets from the sweet shop. You know what I mean? Let's do the Kate effect in The Sun, pages 4 and 5. We haven't talked that much about Kate. I don't think we need to. But this is basically the NHS praising her to say people are now going to get more cancer checks. Let's hope that people can actually be seen by doctors to get
those cancer
checks.
Well, that's the thing.
But, I mean, an incredible story. Cancer Charity is saying it's a great thing. I've got not much more to say about Kate, really. I think it's all been said. I don't particularly want to even go on about the idiots who are still trolling her and making out that things are fake and all of that. You know,
they're lost. They've lost. They've lost their reason. And they've lost their compassion.
And now they're just looking idiotic.
Well, you know what's interesting? Nobody ever talked about the feminists, the self-proclaimed feminists that should be hanging their heads in shame because this is a woman that they were happy to bully, they were happy to spread rumours about her marriage falling apart, all these horrible things. I'm like, oh, so you're a feminist, except when it comes to this particular woman.
Yes,
of course. All of them are hypocrites and vultures.
Yeah, well, it's like the left, as usual. They only like certain kinds of women in the same way that, you know, ethnic minorities only like, if they're on the left, certain type of ethnic minorities. Yeah. You could be the wrong sort of, you know, black person, unfortunately, for them. Anyway, listen, thank you very much to all of you. We're out of time. Laura, Dave, or is it Richard?
I'm so sorry. It's going to stick. Can it stick?
That's all from me.
I love that.
You've been watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Thanks to everybody else who was also, of course, on the show. I'll see you back here tomorrow at 8 p.m, another day closer to Easter. Will the Archbishop of Canterbury mention it? Find out tomorrow. See you later.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.